From the Mayflower and Puritans to plantations and tobacco, canals and railroads expanding straight across America, laying the groundwork for the information age and computing. We're on a tour through centuries this hour, exploring the thread of capitalism and how we arrived to today on this Black Friday, the 24th of November. Boo Srinivasan is the author of the new book, Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. He's an entrepreneur whose work includes digital media, technology, and financial content. He's lived around the U.S. and joins us now from Connecticut. Boo, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Well, some people are listening to this conversation right now and going between store and store in search of deals. It is, after all, Black Friday. What do you think of Black Friday in the context of capitalism?
Well, this is one of the strands that opens my book's third section, which is that the American citizen became the American consumer. So consumerism and citizenship were these two dual strands of the American experience. And that, I argue, had started, you know, right at the turn of the 20th century. And, you know, when you saw the automobile become massively affordable and people had access to it, you all of a sudden saw people get decoupled from the railroads. And this aspect of American freedom was now a part of the consumer event and consumer-driven society. So I thought that was a large part of the theme of the third section and what had informed, you know, the American aspect of citizenship.
Oh, because you could go anywhere, it seemed, to get anything. The boundaries were almost limitless with what you, where you could go to buy things, to see things. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. But now you could buy anything even in 1890 or 1895, for instance. You had the Sears catalog and the Montgomery Ward catalog. So what was incredible about that was that you had a great variety of products that could be delivered via railroad to your nearby railroad station. And from there, you would have, you know, the mailman or various package delivery services actually bring it to your home. So you had people in Omaha, Nebraska, able to access products in New York City. And you had this just, you know, 600-page, 700-page catalog with thousands and thousands of items. And you had a free return policy as well. So there are these very interesting things that you think are very new, but they're actually quite quite old.
Well, from the Sears catalog, JCPenney catalog, to the Amazon of today, what does this say about who we are as a culture?
Well, I think that's the dilemma that we're in, because, you know, all of your shoppers today and all of our shoppers here on the East Coast, you know, when they're going to these stores, they're going to see a lot of products made in China and made in countries, you know, that have very low labor costs. And for the consumer, this has been very good. But for the American citizen and the worker, it obviously has not been so good. At least that's the perception. And that, I think, is the story that's unfolding right before us. And I think that's the issue, is that the consumer versus the citizen is one of the broader themes. It's really not management versus labor, or, you know, the elites versus, you know, the people, but really very much this strand where the consumer is not able to resist savings. And the only way you can deliver products at the lowest possible prices is to find labor costs where they're also the cheapest.
There's this push to buy American, and the fact that lots of imported goods are simply cheaper than domestic products. How is the nation supposed to navigate the challenges of free trade, but also stay true to this intention of wanting to, buy and consume products that are made right here in America?
Well, that's the dilemma. And even Sam Walton had you know, been perplexed by this, because his book was, you know, Made in America, and when he passed away. But even in the mid 80s, he was a part of the group that was really behind the Buy American movement you know, the bumper stickers, everything else. And he tried desperately to source products in the United States.
Walmart, you're saying.
Yes,
right.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart. And that was a difficult thing to do because you just cannot compete with a dollar an hour, 80 cents an hour, $1.20 an hour. Even now, for instance, in textiles, T-shirts, hats, things like that, you know, China cannot afford to do it the way that Bangladesh or Vietnam can do it, or Cambodia. So you have, you know, those lower value goods shifting to other countries that are even cheaper. So that's the perplexing question. Now, at the same time, these American trade deficits have grown and grown and grown. So in a sense, you know, there's this proposition that free trade is a win-win proposition, but it hasn't really been that equal in many ways. You know, it's not that if you say it's win-win, a dollar exported would be a dollar imported, but certainly the American dollars imported are vastly more than the American dollars exported. And that still is an open-ended question.
And it's interesting to say that in light of some very recent news, I was reading today that Foxconn, the Taiwanese company, is in trouble because it's having high school students in China assemble the Apple's iPhone 10, working 11-hour shifts in violation of China's policies for working for children and high school students. Do we see this American capitalism reflected now throughout the world, in the developing world as well?
Absolutely. And that's why I titled the book Americana. Now, it's not wholly original, but, you know, for me, I thought that democracy hasn't necessarily spread to China. And one of the primary aspects of political thinking was that if you have economies liberalized, you would tend to have political systems also liberalize. And that certainly has not happened. And it doesn't look like it's moving in that direction at all. You know, you saw Xi Jinping's rule essentially get far more solidified than what you would have expected several years ago when China continued to grow at 8% a year. So I think that's exactly what this is. This is a spread of American capitalism, whereas it's not necessarily a spread of American democracy.
You say American capitalism is a cycle of creative destructionism. Can you break that down for us?
Well, and that's not a unique novel part of my thinking, but this is creative destructionism is basically a concept that new things always supplant the old. And this is with the automobile and trucking, for instance, replacing railroads. Railroads were the main and dominant part of the commercial artery of the United States. And this arterial system then gave way to the highway and, you know, small country roads that could bring you anything via trucks and automobiles. So, you know, you always have the next big thing supplant the earlier big thing, or it can result in some compounding growth. So you saw this with the railroads and canals, for instance. So canals used to be a very big thing in the 1820s and 1830s, and all of a sudden you saw the railroad able to move goods on land far faster than you could have these man-made water systems. So, you know, the canals, which had enormous amounts of money invested in it, all of a sudden gave way to railroads very quickly. So you can have it both ways. Sometimes you can have this very fast destruction of a previous system, or you could have something give way very slowly, and other times you can have it compound. So for instance, computing and internet, you had, you know, desktop PCs everywhere, and then all of a sudden you had the internet, internet access, and very quickly you have this compounding growth.
What are the implications to the economy when you're continually throwing out what appears to be old or outdated and bringing in the new?
Well, one aspect of it is you have a lot of restlessness and you have a lot of economic uncertainty. And on the other side, you have tremendous new products. And there's an excitement that comes with having access to the latest and the greatest and the newest thing. So, you know, it goes both ways. From a labor perspective, you never know whether you're going to have a place when the economy shifts as quickly as it does. As a consumer, you get to access new products, you know, that you never thought would have been possible before. And other products that you might not have had access to that have become cheaper. For instance, airline tickets. You know, 25 years ago, on a real basis, meaning inflation adjusted, airline tickets were more expensive than they are today. You know, so there are certain types of products that you get more access to, more universal access to once once these things become cheaper with technology, once these types of resources are optimized.
The new book is Americana, a 400-year history of American capitalism, and author Bhu Srinivasan stays with us. You can join in 800-642-1234. Where have you seen the benefits of capitalism? How have you experienced the drawbacks of our country's system? Do you think capitalism was critical at a certain time in history? Is it crucial today? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return after this news. We're on a 400-year history of American enterprise this hour, how capitalism, innovation, and technology have all shaped the U.S. and its economy that we know today. In a Harvard University poll conducted last year, 51% of 18 to 29-year-olds in the U.S. said they opposed capitalism. Only 42% expressed support. Among Americans of all ages, by contrast, a Gallup survey last year found that 60% held positive views of capitalism. We are understanding the layers of capitalism this hour with Bhu Srinivasan. His new book is Americana, a 400-year history of American capitalism. You can join the discussion, 800-642-1234. What does capitalism mean to you? How do you know you're living in a capitalist society? Is that a good thing? And who benefits? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bhu, I want to discuss for a moment your personal story of coming to America as a young boy and your mother, who basically willed you to get on that plane and come to the States, and then your ability to see the whole country. Tell us a little bit in different stages your personal story and what it reveals about capitalism in practice.
Well, thank you for asking that. Yes, I came to this country in 1984, and my mother was to some degree, overeducated in India. She had a PhD in physics, a master's in mathematics, and was underemployed. And so India at that time had millions and millions of people that were educated in the sciences and engineering, and you had an economy that simply could not absorb that type of a labor force. So it was built in a top-down, an elite sort of way, where you didn't have a broad-based labor force and a broad-based industrial infrastructure that can absorb all this high-end labor. So that's what happens when you do that. So my mother came to this country in 1984. She left actually 6 months before us and came back and got us 6 months later. And she was a scientist at Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, New York. And when I arrived in this country, I was sent to Virginia and then joined her later on in Buffalo, New York. And then she then ended up getting a job at a startup in San Diego and then another one in Seattle. So our own migration in this country, you know, started with the Rust Belt and going to the West as a part of the new things. And so, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so for me, that's what the American experience looked like.
And then you yourself ventured into entrepreneurism.
I did in Seattle, when I was attending college at the University of Washington. The internet boom was in full bloom, and I certainly thought that this was the gold rush, the bigger than the gold rush perhaps, and I certainly participated fully.
And didn't it feel like it at the time? That it was a go-go time, and this was the dot-com era was huge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was not just huge, it was extremely exciting, and it was compressed within a very short period of time. You know, you're talking about 2, 3 years, 4 years when you'd have this very fast boom cycle. It was very easy to get capital that time. There were all these new and exciting ideas, and you never knew what was going to happen. So when I'm writing a chapter like going back to the 1840s and writing something on the gold rush, I can easily put myself in the place of these entrepreneurs and people that just drop everything and go to California, because that's really what it felt like. You know, people that are dropping out of colleges or dropping out of careers that they had spent years training for, all of a sudden trying their hand at these startups.
The dot-com boom was this new frontier, if you will, in America's story.
Yes, very much so.
Well, let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Lori, who is calling from Vernon County. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning. It's kind of curious to me. It seems like it's been more of a discussion of American consumerism than capitalism. It's interesting you just compared the dot-com bubble to the gold rush. And, you know, those weren't entrepreneurs that were out there digging up the hinterlands. But so would you talk maybe a little bit about how capital directs the development of a nation? You know, the railroad barons just didn't go out and build. They were given millions of acres. They directed the land speculation of the West. You know, they were incredibly powerful people. You can look at the internet. It just didn't appear overnight. It was created over years with public dollars, and now we're on the verge of privatizing it. So maybe talk a little bit more about the capital and a little bit less about consumerism. Thank you.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah, go ahead, Boo.
Well, thank you, Lori. You know, this is very true, and this is one of the themes that that recurs in my book quite a bit, which is that, you know, the American government has obviously been a very central part of directing the trajectory of American capitalism. So you can look back at with the railroads. Obviously, railroads, to build them, you need eminent domain. So this is something that pits one property rights holder versus another one. So you have somebody that wants to build a railroad, but they obviously need land, and you have to have the power of eminent domain to be able to, in essence, buy that land from a farmer that might not want to sell it to you. And the reason why you have that is because you don't want a railroad to be routed inefficiently, so you have this power. At the same time, you also have bond guarantees. So many of these small towns and states put up bond guarantees or invested directly in the railroads. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, for instance, you know, both the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland had been the original investors in that. You can go back to the canals. You know, the canal was this very big project, and it required the state of New York to sponsor it, and it was by far the largest capital transaction in that era. So, of course, you have that. And the same thing with the telegraph. The telegraph is something where Morse had tried to raise capital for a long time, and he wasn't able to do it until 1844, when he received a $30,000 congressional appropriation to do so. And you can look at that with computing. You know, you have the military-industrial complex, in essence, was the catalyst for investing huge amounts of money in research that eventually gave us many of the products that we enjoy as consumers. It certainly, you know, when you look at Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address, when he coins, you know, and puts into the American lexicon the idea of the military-industrial complex, he talks about computers. He actually mentions the word computers and talks about how the cost of research is the thing that's driving this, driving the expansion of this military-industrial complex, and where you need a permanent military apparatus. So certainly the government has been a central driver in setting the trajectory, but that goes without saying, in my view. You know, obviously when you have automobiles enter American society, you need rules of the road, you need, you know, traffic stops, and you need speed limits, and you need driver's licenses, and you need automobile registrations. So the American government and democracy has always had to keep up with these new innovations, and that you'll see now with privacy, what's going to happen with data, what's going to happen with
net neutrality.
Very much so, exactly. So you have lots and lots of issues that arise when you have new innovations, and there is no ideology that tells you how you should necessarily regulate it, because ideology tells you that it's property versus government, whereas most of the time it's property versus property, where you have telecom companies versus the internet companies in this battle over net neutrality. So that's the complexity. I certainly do not shy away from that at all.
Lori, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Jerry now in West Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Listening to your program this morning, I was kind of reminded about, you know, religion. all right? Being a capitalist or being a socialist, or maybe being a Catholic or a Muslim, it's like, as you put it in this sort of group or identity, that this is capitalism and this is communism. So when we look at, like they looked at Barack Obama as a socialist, you know, it's a name you can put on somebody. But really, it's exchange. It's all exchange. And it's exchange between people. Like, some things you should make money off of. Like, maybe cars and shoes and, you know, hairstyles. Okay? And other things you shouldn't make money off of. Like, sick children. You know, education. We've sort of screwed things up. I mean, really. I mean, how can a first year Spanish book at a college cost $400? Spanish one, or algebra one. It's something we've been teaching for thousands of years. So I guess my point is that we, instead of calling it capitalism as socialism, we should say effective and ineffective.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for calling in. Let's give Boo now a chance to respond to your thoughts.
Well, capitalism is a work in progress, so I certainly didn't mean to use it as a fairly divisive term. But I think that people would tend to think about capitalism and democracy as the two central drivers of the American operating system, if you will. You know, if you remember that old Austin Powers movie where, you know, he comes back from time and he says, you know, did we win? And then first he then realizes that, you know, the West won, and he goes, yay, capitalism. He doesn't say yay, democracy. So for me, that's the aspect that capitalism was the central driver. And you can go back to things where you would think that the Mayflower, the Pilgrims had come over for religious liberty, and then you realize, well, how did they finance this very large ship? And you realize that they sold shares, and it was very much a for-profit venture that made it possible. So I always think that capitalism is this hybrid system, and it's been tempered by American democracy. It's been shaped by it. Certainly, it's had a place for public schools. For instance, you certainly don't pay for public schools, at least directly, and it's not for profit. You know, defense. You can look at the biggest defenders of capitalism. They will never look to cut the defense budget. So you have, you know, obviously defense is a government sponsored entity, and you have for profit and you have not for profit. You have obviously defense contractors that make huge amounts of money, but you have defense as this public good per se. So I think you have this continuous interaction of democracy and markets over time. And that those trade-offs continuously happen, and certainly in the book that I cover, how those trade-offs happen and when they happened.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Boo Srinivasan, the author of the new book, Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. He's an entrepreneur whose work includes digital media, technology, and financial content. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the benefits of capitalism? What are the downsides, the drawbacks of our country's system? Do you think capitalism was critical at a certain point in history? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Boo, you pose the question in your book, would America, and for that democracy, be considered great if America was not rich? What would be the answer to that?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that question. that's a tough question. No, I did pose that, and it's true. I don't necessarily think it would be, and I think that that's the allure that you can have someone, you can have a country like China all of a sudden embrace state capitalism because they know that it's an economic system that can elevate your country to new levels of stature, and certainly I think Indians coming from a democracy, we would not have come to this country if America was not prosperous. And I think it's a difficult thing for maybe traditionalists in America to swallow, but it's certainly the case. You know, you have lots of Indians that go to places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other places in the Middle East that are the furthest thing from capitalism, or furthest thing from democracies, just because they have higher wages. So I think a lot of migration happens and is stimulated by access to prosperity. And many times you'll see people leaving democracies, free countries. There are people in the Middle East that, for instance, come from the Philippines to work in places like Lebanon. I know from personal experience seeing people there. So here's a country that's essentially at the brink of civil war at times, and you have someone here from a democracy in the Philippines coming to work there. So you have that trade-off happen. I think that you need both, obviously. I certainly think that you have tremendous freedom in this country and civil liberties that are coded into the Constitution. I think that's a big driver. But I think that the other aspect of American greatness, the thing that propels it and has at least has sustained it, is the economic engine behind it.
Let's go to Ray now in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. Let me take you off speakerphone first.
Thank you.
Okay.
Much better.
Let me address it from somebody from the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the worst place probably in the world for young black children to grow up. Now, venture capitalism has given startups in Seattle a head start against, let's say, a black entrepreneur in the inner city of Milwaukee who wants to open a restaurant. It's impossible for that person to get a loan, most likely because their parents have been arrested for nonviolent drug offenses, and we lock up more people here in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the world, free world. And capitalism was built on the backs of slavery in this country. That was the beginning of our country. And you come from India, where they have a class of people they call the untouchables. What chance do the untouchables in India have to get a PhD and then send their children to America? You're looking at this through your lens. You need to look at this conversation through the lens of the average person anywhere in the world. Capitalism is a rigged system.
And Ray, let's leave it there for a moment so we can get Boo to respond to you. Go ahead.
And Ray, thank you for bringing that up. First, we certainly were not very prosperous when we came to this country at all. I went to school in inner city Buffalo. I attended maybe 9 or 10 schools from third grade until eighth grade. So I switched schools almost continuously, as we kept moving up and moving out. So it's certainly not a pleasant immigrant experience. So I certainly didn't mean to gloss over that. And inner city Buffalo is not very different from inner city Milwaukee. And I attended schools with many, many African-American children. One of the things that I noted in my introduction is I didn't even know that Africans lived in this country, people of African descent lived in this country. And I definitely do not shy away from that in the book either. There's an entire chapter devoted to slavery. And certainly the second chapter in the book is tobacco. And even before you had cotton as the main cash crop built on the backs of slaves, you had tobacco. So certainly I do not shy away from that. And tobacco and cotton combined, 2 centuries of American exports. I mean, these were the largest cash crops, and they certainly were built on the backs of people that were not paid and people that were owned and generations of people that were owned. So certainly I do not grant any credit to American society for being so free and liberal with that.
And let's go back to slavery and capitalism here on the other side of this news update. We're talking with Boo Srinivasan. His new book is Americana, a 400-year history of American capitalism. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about capitalism and the history of it? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. House Speaker Paul Ryan said a couple months ago that, quote, in our country, the condition of your birth does not determine the outcome of your life. But this idea that every American has an equal shot at moving up in life is quite debatable. Social mobility has declined in recent decades. Median wages have stagnated, and today's young generation is the first in modern history expected to be poorer than their parents. All of this worth bearing in mind as we look at capitalism through time with author Boo Srinivasan. His new book is Americana, a 400-year history of American capitalism. Your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Where have you seen the benefits and the drawbacks of capitalism at work? Who are the winners and losers? Does pure capitalism require some adjustments to benefit communities? How should we apply the ideas differently? 800-642-1234. And Boo, let's go back to this conversation about slavery and the whole concept of winners and losers and the unequal starting place in our country and where we see it today with wages and people having different places to start their prospects of finding their way in life.
Certainly. Well, the African-American experience in this country recurs throughout the book. So, you know, you can't frame that experience in the context of Next Big Things, but I certainly bring it out in terms of cotton, slavery, tobacco, even the move to suburbia, the Great Migration North over a six-decade period in the 20th century. And I think that's as much as you can blame capitalism for the African-American experience, you can also blame democracy. You know, the American Constitution tolerated slavery for decades, and then for another century after liberation, there was segregation. So, you know, as much as you can say capitalism was responsible for slavery and the African-American experience, you can equally place blame on democracy, because that if the American democracy only for the past five decades did it give African Americans equal footing, at least in terms of the law, if not economically. So just as much as democracy is a work in progress, so is the economic system that we have. And I think the economic system that we have is not a pure one. It continuously gets shaped to meet the needs of your society. And capitalism, in my view, is not moral or immoral. It's an amoral system. Just like the climate is not self-aware, this system is not aware of itself. You know, it's up to the society that it operates in to imbue it with the morality that it feels appropriate. So, for instance, you could have a marketplace for, issues of Playboy magazine, which in Saudi Arabia would be considered, you know, absolute blasphemy. So this is something that, it's up to a society to determine what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, or marijuana in this country. You'd have right-wing people that are extremely pro-free market that would be horrified that marijuana might be legalized, whereas someone in Washington and Washington State and California, where these are highly liberal states, you have, pro-marijuana movement. So it's a mixed bag in terms of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and that you can't place at the foot of an economic system. It's up to society to modify it, to suit it.
Let's go to Dina, who joins us from Manitowoc. Hi, Dina.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Wonderful topic today. I'm enjoying the discussion. And one of the things that's always concerned me about capitalism is the tenet of profit maximization. I've long felt it does not factor in all of the costs of production, like the environment and just the greater good of the people. So when Boo talks about, it's up to the society, I think capitalism has made government inaccessible and greed is just entrenched. So I'm just wondering, is that something that your book looks at, is how greed factors in perhaps over time?
Absolutely. I mean, capitalism can have great excesses, certainly. Environmentally, that's certainly one thing. But the consumer oftentimes is very much a driver of that as well. You know, in terms of automobiles, every time oil prices go down just a little bit, people get bigger and bigger cars and bigger engines. So, you know, I think to place it entirely at the hands of a few people, the thing with capitalism is consumers drive that society. So it's not the opposite way. You know, this is 70% of GDP is consumer spending in America. So everything ultimately trickles down to the consumer, or the consumer is a central aspect of change in this country. That's why you have retail dying in physical stores and online growing. It's not that there's some great master that's manipulating that. It really is the consumer wants lower prices, and they choose to make those trade-offs. And at the same time, you've also had many of these people that are known in history as the robber barons. They also started giving away massive amounts of money as well. So you look at the University of Chicago or Carnegie Mellon or Stanford or Vanderbilt. The fact that you have Gates and Buffett giving away 99% of their fortunes now. I just think to think about these capitalists in one-dimensional terms is a disservice. And at the same time, it doesn't give you a very accurate picture of all of the things that that have influenced them and influenced American society overall. So I think certainly you can have great excesses in all democracy can have excesses as well.
And the nugget there about capitalism making governments more inaccessible that Dina brought up, it brings me to this thought in your book, American leaders have rejected capitalism in times of crisis. In World War II, private companies became the production and service organizations to promote the government's war effort. Tell us about Ford Motor Company and the B-24 Liberator bomber.
Exactly. So, and it's not just Ford. Everyone was in the service of the war. And by the way, you know, these were highly profitable times as well for many American companies. But you know, the World War II is a great example of the government, in essence, stopping capitalism and taking over, nationalizing the vast majority of the big American industries. Consumer automobile purchases nearly stopped, and all of these companies, from Ford to General Motors, Chrysler, had to be repurposed for the war effort. And then at the end of the war, it had to revert back to market-oriented capitalism. But certainly, I don't think that we've had a pure framework for capitalism in this country ever. It's always been the government, consumers, citizens, driving and shaping what many of these corporations do and how the economic trajectory gets set.
Let's talk for a moment about American brands and how they fit into the conversation. You mentioned you go into Remington brand, and it started out as a family name. But what is the story of Remington and how it fits into capitalism?
Well, that goes back to an earlier war. And the earlier war was that Remington and many of the New England gun makers were instrumental for the Union war effort. And right after the government contract stopped flowing, they had to find new things to do. And all of a sudden, Remington stumbled upon an invention by three men that could fire letters, instead of bullets. And you had the typewriter. So the Remington typewriter then all of a sudden made it possible for business communication to become far more efficient, far more accurate, and that also led to women coming into the white-collar workforce. So you had lots and lots of secretaries and typists that entered the workforce, and you'd have things in literary journals that would talk about with 6 months' worth of training, a woman could make more than a school teacher. So there was this great demand in the late 1800s for women to enter the workforce in the office environment as typists.
Let's go to Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm, from Wisconsin now for 10 years and really impressed by cooperatives here in Wisconsin. I work in a cooperative in Rice Lake. I was just wondering what the author thinks about cooperatives in a capitalistic system, because I know it provides value to members and just seems to be a more equal method of distributing benefits and stuff like that.
Boo, go ahead. Yeah, cooperatives.
Well, I think that the cooperatives, for instance, the Granger movement in the 1800s, the mid-1800s, and it's one of the things that Montgomery Ward had looked to these farmer cooperatives to give them wholesale purchasing power with his catalog. So that's one of the first things that first groups that he had targeted, these farmer cooperatives. But at the same time, merchants that were out in the country, they all of a sudden, were quite angry that Montgomery Ward and the catalog systems would come in there and disrupt their ability to sell to farmers. So that's one of the things that you have. Anytime you have cooperatives or one particular movement, you have an opposite side that gets affected. But I haven't seen in the American experience that cooperatives can dominate in any large way. I just don't think that it's sustained, primarily because members of the cooperative ultimately want to go outside of it if something is just far cheaper. I think it requires a great deal of discipline to remain in a cooperative and not have your self-interest somewhat dominate. This is the reason that cartels many times fall apart, that you know, you just can't have members stick to it when there are temptations outside of the cooperative.
Boo, in the final minute that we have with you, who decides what capitalism looks like in America? Is it the individual working toward prosperity? Is it the state? Is it the federal government?
I think it's all. I think it's the consumer, it's the citizen, it's big corporations, it's individual entrepreneurs, and it's also external events. External events and external actors such as nation states, and at the same time, it's natural resources. You know, one of the things that's informed this book in a great way is that, you know, the extent of natural resource wealth in the United States. America from 1859 until the early 1970s was the largest oil producer on earth. So many times people tend to think that it's American culture that was the central driver of its entrepreneurial energy, but it also always had great natural resource wealth. And certainly the oceans as defensive assets, you know, what happens when the oceans aren't quite as defensive if you can have missiles come all the way from across oceans and land in America. So all of these things inform the shape of it, in my view.
Well, Boo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Boo Srinivasan is author of the new book, Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. He's an entrepreneur whose work includes digital media, technology, and financial content. And he joined us from Connecticut. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Brianne Shasso. Dave Potraz provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.